Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
A U.S. soldier on why troops might be snapping in Iraq. Also, Congress begins hearings on a little-known practice, pretexting. This is private companies pretending they're someone else, maybe pretending they're you, to get your phone information and, in many cases, reportedly give it to the government. But first, former Bush administration official David Safavian has been found guilty of covering up his dealings with disgraced Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Safavian, a former chief of staff of the General Services Administration and top federal procurement officer, was convicted of lying about a 2002 golfing trip to Scotland with Abramoff, as well as obstructing of government investigation. This is the first trial related to the Abramoff scandal. In January, Abramoff pleaded guilty to fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials in a deal that requires him to provide evidence about members of Congress. Well, joining us with the latest on this case is Jeffrey Birnbaum, a national reporter for the Washington Post. Jeffrey, welcome.
Hi.
And the infamous Scotland golf trip played a role in this trial. Safavian went with Abramoff, Republican Congressman Bob Ney of Ohio, and two of Ney's aides went as well, as did Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition. How did that trip play into this case?
Well, it was central to the case. The entire case was built around Safavian's lying to two separate officials at the General Services Administration, where he was the chief of staff at the time of the trip back in 2002, and then again lying to Senate investigators a couple years later who were looking into the whole Abramoff scandal and Abramoff's relationship to Indian tribes, which is where he got a lot of his money.
Safavian was also accused of giving insider information to Abramoff on two government properties. One of them would have been, according to reports, for one of those Indian tribes. Abramoff was interested in buying the properties. What else was Safavian's connection to Abramoff?
Well, Safavian had actually worked for Abramoff as a lobbyist before he went back into government, first as a House aide for a congressman, and then moving on to his own lobbying firm separate from Abramoff, and then going back into government as the chief of staff of the General Services Administration. Safavian eventually moved up even from there to become the White House's top procurement policy official, making him a very high-ranking official indeed, in fact, the highest-ranking government official to be caught in the snare of the Abramoff scandal, which is now spreading.
Well, hundreds of emails between Safavian, Neil Volz, who was ex-chief of staff to Congressman Ney, who was a key witness for the prosecution, and Jack Abramoff, were the centerpiece of this case. How were those emails reverberating?
Well, the prosecutors did not even bother to put Abramoff on the stand, using instead the emails between Safavian and Abramoff to explain and make very clear that Safavian and Abramoff were exchanging a lot of information about the two properties you're talking about. One is the old post office building, which is right in between the White House and the Capitol and the Capitol itself along Pennsylvania Avenue, and another is a piece of property outside the U.S. Capitol Beltway, if you will, in Maryland. They made clear first that the two were exchanging a lot of information, including some non-public information, and then in exchange for that, Safavian was taking a variety of favors, including and especially this trip to Scotland for golf.
Well, we have less than a minute here. David Safavian will be sentenced on October 12th, could see 20 years in jail. How is this reverberating in Washington?
Well, I think that this will embolden federal prosecutors to seek more indictments against Abramoff cronies. As you mentioned, Abramoff is cooperating with federal prosecutors. I think in particular, this will probably loosen some lips. If anyone was worried, was not worried that the prosecutors could really make a case stick here, I think they don't. There's no doubt now. And so I think we may see at least one and probably several more indictments, possibly of members of Congress, and not too soon, not too long from now because of this conviction.
Jeffrey Birnbaum, national reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
to Iraq, where the bodies of two U.S. soldiers reported missing last week are believed to have been recovered. An Iraqi official says the men were killed in a barbaric way. Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed responsibility for killing the soldiers. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army has charged three other soldiers in connection with the deaths of three Iraqis who were in military custody in northern Iraq last month. The three U.S. troops, members of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team 101st Airborne Division, are also charged with threatening to kill a fellow soldier if he told on them. The three men may, of course, be cleared. But if not, Iraq veteran Paul Rykoff won't be surprised. He says some soldiers are corrupted by war. They become, in the words of the Iraqis, the Ali Baba, the bad guys. Paul Rykoff served 10 months in Iraq as first lieutenant and infantry platoon leader for the New York National Guard, leading 38 men on hundreds of combat patrols with the 35th Infantry and 1st Armored Divisions. His new book called Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington, tells of his combat experiences, but also his afterlife as an outspoken critic of the way the Bush administration ran the war. He is executive director and founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and Paul joins us in the studios. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's just touch on that news, the three soldiers charged in the deaths of three detainees in Iraq. Of course, you are well aware also the allegations of the massacres of Haditha. You write that there are rules of engagement in Iraq, but the enemy doesn't follow them. And you write further. If you don't mind, I'm going to just read a paragraph that seemed to strike me as I heard of this week's news. You write, there are so many reasons for us to be angry. The heat, the shooting, the outdated flak jackets, the lack of information, the bad food, the improvised explosive devices, the sight of our wounded buddies, the lack of sex, the holidays missed, the boredom, the uncertainty, the complete and total lack of control over our own lives. So many reasons to be pissed. And only one group of people to take it out on, the Iraqis. Do you think, you can't know, you can't be inside the head of this incident, you weren't there. Do you think U.S. soldiers are taking it out on Iraqis?
I think, unfortunately, sometimes they do. We're seeing, I think, an increase in these types of incidents because in many ways the system and the people involved in the system are starting to show signs of wear. They're worn out. They're tired. And I think as the insurgency increases, they don't really feel as though they have an outlet for that frustration. They're rarely coming home for R&R. They'll get a few weeks. But extended tours, sometimes a year or more, and some units like the 101st, for example, has just about been gone since 9/11. Mm-hmm. Some of the brigades there did a tour in Afghanistan, and now some of them are on their second tour in Iraq. So I think you're seeing signs of wear, and when the Iraqi people are your enemy at times and sometimes they're your friend and you're dealing with this nebulous, murky environment, I think oftentimes they do become the source of the frustration that our troops have on the ground, unfortunately.
I want to ask you more about the stresses that you faced in Iraq. I mean, at one point, you had your hands on the neck of an Iraqi civilian. We want to hear that story. But first, how it all started. You were a graduate of Amherst College here in Massachusetts. You went to work on Wall Street. You say September 11th changed everything for you. How so?
Well, I was there. I was in New York City during the attacks on the World Trade Center, and I went down there that day to try to help participate in the rescue effort, and I spent a few weeks there digging up bodies and trying to establish security and just doing what I could to chip in, and I wanted payback. That was my hometown. That was my turf, and I wanted to get the guys who were responsible for that. So I volunteered to go to Afghanistan. I wasn't called to go, but ultimately I was called to go to Iraq, and once I got to Baghdad, I realized that the plan just wasn't there to deal with the insurgency, to deal with the looting, to deal with the security situation, to deal with the humanitarian aid that was necessary. And I point the finger at the folks in Washington. People like Donald Rumsfeld and the president blew off some of the best military knowledge that we had at our disposal in this country and conducted a war on the cheap. And I think years later, we're still paying the price for those big decisions.
These are things that, you know, are well into the national dialogue, but you give us insight into how they impacted the soldier on the ground. For instance, only one interpreter for every four squads when no one spoke the language. As you say, the Army loves to say we own the night, but only a few of you had tactical nightlights and you bought them yourselves.
Right.
And you were astonished at the lack of cultural awareness of some of the guys that you work with. In fact, if I'm remembering correctly, you started sort of a quiz game and what did you learn?
Well, I learned that my guys were extremely culturally ignorant about what we were doing in Iraq, what the people were like there, the differences between Sunni and Shia, the language, the
history. That men kissed each other?
Sure. The history of Islam, understanding that it was a traditional greeting in Arab cultures to kiss on the cheek. So I think that there was a serious lack of planning down to the individual soldier level. You've heard criticisms from policy wonks and from four-star generals, but I wanted to really show people how these policy decisions affect the people on the ground, how not having interpreters interpreters made my infantry squads much less successful. We couldn't communicate. It became this complex game of Pictionary or pantomime where you have to try to communicate with hand and arm signals.
And you're dealing with, I mean, this was a two-way street. Of course, Iraqis knew very little about American soldiers, but many of the things they did know were wrong. They thought that your combat boots could detect and defuse landmines and that your goggles could see through women's clothing.
Yeah, yeah. I write about a scene where old women were kind of diving behind cars when they saw us scan with our Oakley wraparound sunglasses because they thought we could see through their clothes and they were embarrassed. I mean, there were really, you know, misconceptions on both sides and a lack of awareness and understanding, especially in those initial months when I think there were a lot of stereotypes and Iraqis had been told that in order to be a Marine, you had to kill your parents and our tanks had force fields around them. But then at the same time, there was a huge technological difference that gives you reason to understand why they had these misconceptions. You know, we could see in the dark. That sounds like a crazy thing, but it was a fact. When we had AA batteries, which were tough to find, we could see in the dark. We had thermal sights that could see through buildings, and you could see heat sources. So the technological advances created a very interesting gap between the two cultures, especially early on.
Right. You could see in the dark, but you were not looking at their women through their clothing.
Right.
Which is what they thought.
Right.
The criticisms mount in your book. You get more and more frustrated, and so do your guys. But how is this different, Paul, from War at All Times? It seems that, you know, and I only know from literature, of course, but, you know, one of the unifying factors for a unit is that everybody hates the guy at the top. You know,
right.
Everybody thinks this is stupid and our food's terrible and, you know, that's a part of creating unity.
And ultimately, what I found is that the threat of death is the ultimate unifying force. It's not, you know, when we go over there, ultimately, it's not for the president, it's not for a policy, and it's not even for this country. You know, when it comes down to it, the reason why you fight is for the man or woman to left and right of you. That's what drives you through. That's what motivates you. That's what creates that cohesion. There is always going to be, you know, some degree of hostility or resentment toward the chain of command, especially among enlisted soldiers who feel like they're bearing most of the burden. They're taking most of the risk. And if you watch the news, they take most of the casualties. You don't see too many colonels or lieutenant colonels or generals dying in Fallujah and Baghdad. They're lower enlisted soldiers and junior officers. So there is a different experience among that cross-section of our military. And I think they do bind together because of the toughness of the situation, the hostility and the danger. That does bring them together. And they're always going to whine and complain about certain aspects of higher command. But, you know, big issues like a mission, that should be something that we shouldn't have to think about. We should have a mission. We should have a clear goal. We should have clear objectives. And the fact that we don't in this war, I think, is ultimately really starting to take a tremendous toll on our troops.
The American media comes in for great disdain on your part. Why?
It's changed to some extent, but I think that's a reaction to the political environment. They feel it's safer now to be critical of the war, to show casualties or show controversial subjects like Haditha. I don't know if we would have seen the same level of intense coverage with Haditha if it had happened 2 years ago. The Pentagon and the Bush administration had done a much more aggressive job of intimidating the media, and I think the environment has come a long way from where we were 2-3 years ago.
That's Paul Rykoff. He served in Iraq for 10 months, leading combat patrols with the 3rd Infantry, 1st Armored Division, National Guard. His new book, Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. We'll have more with Paul when we come back. Also, don't forget, later in the program, Calvin Trillin on writing deadline poetry, much of it about the war in Iraq. Much more coming up here and now. Rykoff, he writes about his 10-month tour of duty in Iraq and his new book, Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. And Paul, in the book, you write about some pretty horrible Iraqi casualties because you say, you know, U.S. combat troops suddenly became occupying troops. You say Americans rarely hear about these casualties, but veterans, you know, live with them. I'm thinking of a little girl in a blue dress whose head was blown off because the car she was riding in didn't stop at a checkpoint, probably a misunderstanding. Another case, I think it sounded like a retarded Iraqi who was killed by American soldiers who just didn't know what he was doing.
He ran to a door as our unit was making a breach on a door, and he had a toy gun in his hand. And he was a retarded guy, and as he was coming to the door, one of the squad leaders saw a man with a gun coming toward the door. And it's a mistake. It's an accident. It's not something anyone planned. It wasn't where we lined up civilians and shot them in a massacre. The other incident on a checkpoint, you know, you've got a car barreling towards you in the dark of night, and you don't know what's in that car. You don't know if it's filled with explosives or it's filled with a family with children. And you've got these split-second decisions that you've got to make, and you're asking a 19-year-old who's, you know, 7,000 miles away from home in a land where he doesn't speak the language to make these tremendously huge decisions that will affect not only his unit in that local area, but our global foreign policy. So I think one of the things I really try to bring light to is the enormity of the responsibility that we're asking everyone to do when we deploy them to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, and then there is the your account of you were guarding a medical center, which sounded like a hellish place, and there was a guy who controlled the blood supply, and you found out that he was corrupt and he was making money off this blood supply, and he refused to relinquish three units for a little girl who needed it to live. So you and your guys go over there to shake this guy up a little bit, and you get so angry at him that you grab him by the throat. His eyes are bulging out. You slam him back against the wall. You're a big guy. He could have died.
Yeah.
And especially in light of these stories that we're hearing of Iraqis who did die, would you have felt justified?
Well, I was restrained in that I didn't kill him. I think I could have, and I would, you know, I don't think it would have been justified. But my anger brought me to that point. There was a young girl with her legs blown apart, and this guy wouldn't give her blood because he hadn't been paid enough money, and because she was from a different sect, and there was rampant corruption, and life had become cheap at times in Iraq, especially after the fall of Baghdad, and we were dealing with very difficult situations, and sometimes we had to use force to convince people. We had to use our power to be able to try to protect the weak. And this man was exploiting his position. He was taking advantage of the local population. He was guarding his blood supply and making money off it. And a little girl was dying. So I don't apologize for slamming him against the wall and getting the blood, because ultimately that's what we did. And we also sent a powerful message to him that you've got to be able to try to deliver to these people who need help. I mean, this is a hospital and we're all in a tough situation, but he has a job to do, and that's to supply blood to people who need it. And we've got a job to do, and that's to try to establish some semblance of security and try to help as many people as we can.
This is where we get to such a squirrely place, though, because we don't know what's happening in the ongoing investigations, but another soldier might say, let's say in Haditha, he was justified in storming a house because he really, really thought that the source of the explosive device that killed his pal was in that house. I mean, it seems like a very thin line.
It is, and I think that's really why we need to be responsible in our coverage and in our analysis to try to let the facts come through. Let's have somewhat of a thorough investigation here before we jump to conclusions and try people in the court of public opinion. I've been in situations similar to that where one of our own has been killed and you don't know where it's come from and there's civilians around, and I know how murky that situation can be. Now, if there was a massacre, those people need to be held accountable, and I'm not making any excuses. If that took place, they're an embarrassment to us all and they need to be held accountable. However, we don't know what happened. And I think when Congressman Murtha and maybe members of the press jump to conclusions, they're really being premature in their judgments. We don't know what happened there, and if we want to speed up the investigation, great. And if there's a cover-up that we need to unveil, absolutely, let's do that. But let's not jump to conclusions and try these people in the media or in the court of public opinion, because we're not judge and jury. We understand the ramifications are tremendous of a situation like this, and we owe it to everyone involved to let the facts come through.
I guess I'm just saying that here you are telling your story in a book. If your squeeze had been just a little tighter than you planned, you could have had a dead Iraqi in your hand.
Sure. And I could have had, you know, five dead soldiers on my hand, too. I think the thing I try to show in my book is that in these situations, there is rarely a good solution. There's just one that's less bad. And you've got to try to balance that in the condensed time frame of 5 or 6 seconds. You know, make the decision quickly right now. And it's going to affect you, this local community, five soldiers who have five wives, who have 10 kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ripple effects of every decision are really profound.
You write, to experience raids in Baghdad is to understand and why America can't win this war without Iraq severely changing. And I'm remembering one image you painted of a raid and what you thought were these ninja fighters all dressed in black running away. But wait, they turned out to be women who were practically enslaved by some guy and picking dates.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That image of these women looking like ninja fighters, but really farmers in a way.
Yeah, they would have looked like what we thought were Al Qaeda fighters or any of the special operations units that were under Saddam, and they were dressed like black ninjas head to toe, and we were told that that's what, you know, some of the enemy fighters looked like, and they were a very isolated group of farmers, and they had never seen Americans before. This was a few months into the war, and they looked at us like we had been beamed down from Mars, and we were afraid of them, and I think it shows a little bit of the tension and the lack of clarity that exists. It's very hard. You don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. Both are skeptical and fearful of the other's intentions, and it's really, an illustration of how complex this insurgent fight is and how complex the battlefields of Iraq are. There's so much gray area. It's very rarely black and white. It's often these murky, confusing decision-making times where you're called on to do quite a bit. And we make amazing bonds at times, and we can, you know, bridge social barriers and cultural barriers, but it's a very, very dangerous and very tense interaction.
I'm thinking of the janitor who befriended your unit, the Iraqi janitor, who crawled into work one day with a bullet lodged in his neck, but he brought his cousin, and he wanted to make sure his cousin did the janitor work that day. Well, he had a bullet in his
neck. We couldn't help this guy. We couldn't bring him to our battalion surgeon because we hadn't fired on him. It wasn't our fault. It was kind of an incidental contact. And my guys banded together and pulled their own personal money to send him to an Iraqi civilian doctor to have the bullet removed. He was our friend. And I think that's a piece of the puzzle that people don't often understand, is that there are friendships forged. And the Iraqi civilians and the American troops have their fates intimately intertwined every day.
Paul Rykoff, he's author of Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington, about his 10 months serving in Iraq, and now spending time in Washington advocating for Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBY. The National Security Agency may not be the only arm of government collecting phone call information about Americans without court permission. Congress is holding hearings this week to find out whether some local police departments, the Homeland Security Department, even the FBI, are also buying sensitive personal information such as cell phone records from so-called private data brokers who are willing to sell the information to anyone or give it to the government, often for free. The issue came to the forefront recently when a blogger bought the cell phone records of former presidential candidate General Wesley Clark. So is it legal to obtain this information? In a moment, we're going to hear from the congressman running the investigation and from a privacy expert who's been very involved in all of this. But first, we turn to Bob Sullivan, technology correspondent for MSNBC.com. Bob, welcome.
Hi.
And this is kind of confusing. We understand that these data brokers have been doing this for years, but that Congress has been investigating this since February. What is new? What's new about this?
Well, I think this is one of those situations where a funny thing happened on the way to the truth. You mentioned the Wesley Clark incident, and since the beginning of this year, there has been all sorts of legislation introduced to stop this practice of private investigators buying or tricking their way into people's cell phone records. But as Congress investigated it, it emerged quite clearly that law enforcement officials, local and federal, were among the biggest customers of these private investigators.
Yeah, so you know, ordinary citizens were getting scammed. Celebrities were having some of their information discovered by these private companies. But now we come to find out that perhaps agencies, government agencies, are also getting this information. So what happened during that investigation? Why didn't it go further?
Well, the investigation apparently has, you know, stopped where it is, because right now the toing and froing in Washington is, how is this illegal? How illegal is it? And, you know, right now the atmosphere in Washington is something like this. We can't do anything to get in the way of Homeland Security. We can't do anything to get in the way of fighting terrorism. We can't even stop, or maybe we shouldn't even stop, the purchase of people's cell phone records.
Well, we understand we're going to be talking to Robert Douglas. He's an information security consultant. He was involved in these investigations, and he resigned in April because he felt that the committee wasn't exploring it seriously enough, because charges came that the NSA was doing the same thing. So it, again, would be undermining the NSA to further the investigation. Some Democrats are saying the same thing. We'll find out about that. But what is the law? Can a private company do something called pretexting? Tell us about this pretexting. Apparently, call your phone company, even fake their voice to try to get your information. Can they do that?
Well, that's right. Here's basically what happens: is one of these digital private investigators will call up a phone company like Verizon and pretend to be someone else. And they'll say, you know, gee, I'm at work and I'm afraid my bill's going to be late. Could you fax me a copy of my cell phone bill at work so I can pay it? And if they call 10 times, maybe the 10th operator will fall for that trick. That's one of the ways that they do it. Now, a lot of the investigators claim that this is not expressly illegal. It has been made expressly illegal to do this for financial records, but not other kinds of records. But most people in this realm will really tell you that that's fraud, that they're breaking the FTC Act, which is an unfair and deceptive trade practice, and they're pretending to be somebody else. So I think it's a pretty thin argument that this is legal.
And in fact, during the investigations, we understand that some some email exchanges were recovered where people in these data companies said that they knew what they were doing was illegal.
I mean, ultimately, these records do belong to the consumers. They don't even belong to the companies. So anyone else possessing them, that's pretty clearly a crime, I think.
But on the other hand, we should rush to say that some of these, they call themselves information brokers, they say they're providing a valuable service. They're tracking down, you know, stalkers and deadbeat dads.
And deadbeat dads. Yeah, the deadbeat dad thing always comes out, and perhaps that they do, but you know, we have to, us journalists have to look in the mirror here. This practice has been around a long time, and one of the ways that it's been used, for example, is to hound famous people who are in the news, like the family of JonBenet Ramsey. Apparently, this technique was even used in some of the Clinton-Lewinsky investigations. So this is a sort of an incredibly effective way to find out what's going on in someone's life.
Now, of course, the concern is that it's being used by agencies such as local police, perhaps Homeland Security, the FBI. We're talking to Bob Sullivan, technology correspondent for MSNBC.com, about these data collectors using things, something called pretexting to get your phone information and perhaps turn it over to the government or an ex-spouse. Bob, hold on right there, because before we went on the air, I spoke with Congressman Ed Whitfield of Kentucky. He's heading the investigation by the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and I started by asking him, how did he feel about data brokers?
Well, I'm quite disturbed about the data brokers. All of this information is just now really coming to the forefront, and this will be the first two hearings that the Energy and Commerce Oversight has had on this subject matter, and I think anyone would be genuinely disturbed if they knew all the facts of what's going on with supposedly private information.
We're going to hear some of the techniques that are used, including changing voices from male to female, for instance. But who are some of the victims that are going to be appearing before the hearing?
Well, the one individual is a businessman in New York, and but you know, we've actually seen credit card statements from all sorts of movie stars, public figures, a basketball player in the NBA playoffs. This can happen to any individual, and anyone, any of these data brokers can get information about your bank account, your credit card statement. They can get any information about you they want to get.
Well, some of they say, these information brokers say that they provide a valuable service to creditors, to attorneys, to private investigators, to catch bad people, you know, the deadbeat dads and fugitives. And apparently they are also saying that they are helping the government.
Well, it's also quite clear that they do not care who they sell this information to. They could be selling this information to a stalker. There's no preclearance on it whatsoever. And, yeah, we know that law enforcement is using some of this information because they've indicated that that's the case. But at the same time, it's essential that we make sure that they use their subpoena powers. And that's the whole purpose of these hearings, to bring all of this out into the open, to have a full discussion about it, and to determine what can we do to maximize the privacy of individuals.
Just one last question, Congressman. Isn't there a problem to try to regulate this when, in fact, some of them are saying and their lawyers are saying, we are doing the same exact thing as the government is doing? The NSA and the president has said that he has the right for his warrantless gathering of records and information because of the war on terror. And some of these data brokers are saying they are helping the FBI and other agencies fight crime.
Well, the data brokers, it's interesting they're telling you that because they're not willing to testify before our committee. They're all taking the Fifth Amendment, so they must not feel particularly comfortable that they're involved in a law-abiding enterprise if they're not willing to testify. And it's our intent to get into all of this, but I can tell you these data brokers are not about securing America from terrorist attacks. They're about providing information to anyone about anything for a dollar.
That's Kentucky Congressman Ed Whitfield, who's heading up the investigation into private data brokers at the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is holding hearings on the subject this week. We've also been speaking with Bob Sullivan, technology correspondent for MSNBC.com, who's been reporting on how these data brokers are providing information about private citizens to law enforcement agencies, local police departments, and the FBI, often using something called pretexting, faking their names, sometimes their voices, to find out your phone number. And, of course, this comes against the backdrop of the NSA getting information about U.S. citizens from telephone companies without warrants. You're listening to Here and Now. And joining us now is someone who resigned from Congressman Whitfield's investigation. Rob Douglas is an information security consultant. He runs privacytoday.com. And Rob, do I understand this correctly that you resigned from Congressman Whitfield's investigation in last April? He said he was unaware of that. But if it's true, why did you stop working with the committee?
Well, I did stop working with the committee because early on in the investigation, after my first testimony on February 1st of this year revealing these practices to the larger Commerce Committee, they brought me on board. I gave them a lot of information on the brokers that they will call before Congress tomorrow. But it became apparent quite early on that law enforcement were indeed using these companies. We had direct responses from the companies stating that they were selling to Homeland Security and the FBI, and it became apparent that the committee was not going to fully investigate those claims. So at that
point, do you think that is? Why do you think that is?
Well, it was in the context of the same time frame of when the NSA revelations were coming out for the second go-around, and I think that they did not want to, and nor did they anticipate that this would be where the evidence took them, that they wanted to make an example of the brokers that the congressman just mentioned will take the Fifth Amendment tomorrow. And, of course, they will take the Fifth Amendment because they know what they've been doing is illegal. But as that played out, it became clear that, indeed, they were selling to federal, state, and local law enforcement, raising very significant Fourth Amendment issues.
And Rob, hold on a second, because Bob Sullivan's with us from MSNBC.com. And, Rob, this is the squirrely part, too, because the lawyers for the data companies are saying, hey, wait a minute, the government's doing the same thing, and we feel that we're doing it for national security as well, and that's when they turn over information to the government.
Well, that's not really why they make these claims. Remember, I've been investigating these companies for 9 years. What they want to do, and as the reporting in the AP today points out, PDJ out of Texas says, well, look, we did it for free. They want that relationship with a law enforcement officer so they can use it as a trump card just as they are today to make the very claim they're making today that, hey, don't come after us because law enforcement is doing it too.
And Rob, I just want to ask you, you're an information security consultant. What are some of the ways that these companies do this pretexting, get this information?
Well, Bob Sullivan mentioned one. The most common is just to impersonate the customer themselves, to call into the customer call center and convince the call center representative that they're the client, and then they'll turn over anything. They also, you will learn tomorrow in the case of the New York businessman, that a woman by the name of Michelle Gambino hijacked his online access. People who have online access who have not set that up leave it wide open, and anyone can go in there and hijack it. But you will also find out that people like James Rapp, who will testify tomorrow, would impersonate federal law enforcement officers, INS officers,
inspectors. You said people even change their voices. They have equipment, they just change their voice.
And they use caller ID spoofing so that they can make the call look like it's coming from law enforcement, coming from the bank, coming from the customer themselves, coming from a federal official. It's a fairly intricate process that is used, and they're always looking for access to consumer records.
Bob Sullivan with MSNBC. Where does this go? For the average consumer, if you go to switchboard.com on the Internet to find someone's number, a web link pops up. It gives you that information for a small fee. That's not nefarious. Is that illegal? Will that become illegal if this investigation goes deep enough?
I think it's actually going to become more legal right now. One of the problems with these stories, and I've done a number of stories like this over the years, is that I think they just fall into one general category for consumers where they feel helpless. All my information is out there in all these different places, and I think a lot of people just feel everyone already has it. So it's hard to get excited about one of these individual stories.
Yeah. Well, but people get a little more excited when they think that the information is going to their government without a warrant. We're speaking to Bob Sullivan, technology correspondent for MSNBC.com, and also Bob Sullivan, Bob right there. Rob Douglas, information security consultant. He runs privacytoday.com. And we want to talk to you further about this as these hearings get underway. Can we have you back?
Of course.
We thank you both. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. week as deadline poet for the liberal magazine The Nation, Calvin Trillin sums up his thoughts about the Bush administration in verse. The title of his first collection of such poems sums up the tone. It's called Obliviously On He Sails, and it was published in 2004. But despite Calvin Trillin's best efforts, George W. Bush was reelected. Oh well, as Trillin has said, we weren't going to know whether or not you could bring down a presidency with iambic pentameter until somebody tried it. Well, now Trillin's back with a heck of a job, more of the Bush administration in rhyme, which includes this election.
A presidential explanation of patriotic loafing. If terror changes what you've always done, well then the terrorists have really won. Right now, when vicious terrorism's rife, it's vital to maintain a balanced life. So live your whole life now, not just a fraction. Unless, of course, you've just been killed in action.
And poet Calvin Trillin joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
Yeah, that is such a great illustration of how often in reading your poems, one might smile and then there's a barb. And that is I think that's one of the more pointed ones.
Yes, I think it is. Well, I think when the subject is people who are getting killed over there, then it's more likely to be that way. I think poems, or whatever these are, bits of doggerel or something, are more like political cartoons than they are like editorials.
Right. Well, but let's get back to the word doggerel, because...
Right, we're not afraid of that word. We can look that word in the face.
Well, is that the point, that you have a point of view and there you go? And because some might say, well, the Democrats, you know, they have plenty of material too.
Well, they do, but they're not in power. I had 8 years of Bill Clinton, and of course many complaints about the fact that his name doesn't rhyme with anything. And even when I wrote about Hillary Clinton, I had to use what we used to call her maiden names. I guess it would be her name of origin or slave name, perhaps. during the unpleasantness then, I wrote when she was taking the lead in defense of her husband, and so it's up to our Ms. Rodham to prove Bill's White House isn't Sodom. It's up to this adroit senora to show that it is just Gomorrah.
And as you write in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, it is a little bit about names that rhyme. For instance, George Bush handed you Condoleezza Rice.
Condoleezza Rice was wonderful because, or is wonderful, because her name fits exactly into the meter of the March of the Siamese Children from The King and I. Condoleezza Rice, who is cold as ice, is precise with her advice. You can almost hear the piano in the background.
Is that the da-da-da-da-da?
That's right. That's right.
Condoleezza Rice.
Well, I'm glad you're going to sing this, Robin.
That's right.
You're the first host who's been willing to sing on air.
Would you mind giving us a little more? I mean, Condoleezza Rice, who is cold as ice, is precise with her advice, the first line.
In her can be found talents that abound. She's renowned, though tightly wound. Yes, talents can be found, and yes, she's tightly wound. She once avowed we might see a large mushroom cloud if more rain by Hussein were allowed, which turned out to be total bourgeois. Yes, total bourgeois. When she accused him of buying tubes only used to make nukes, the truth was abused. And she knew she spoke total bourgeois. Yes, total bourgeois. So to serve her guy, she will testify to a lie she hopes you'll buy. To try to petrify, precisely tell a lie. Condoleezza Rice, who is cold as ice, is precise with her advice. Yes, she is quite precise. And yes, she's cold as ice.
All right, well, tell us how you really feel about Condoleezza Rice. I mean, is this part of what this affords you? You can do things in these four or five lines tucked into the pages that you couldn't really do otherwise.
I actually think you can say things, if you say it in rhyme, that you wouldn't say in prose. For instance, we had a senator in New York, Alphonse D'Amato, who some columnists used to call the most corrupt man in the Senate, and his name was hard to rhyme. It rhymes with tomato, of course, but I'm from the Midwest, and I can't bring myself to say tomato. And I finally realized it rhymes with sleazeball obligato. Well, I'm not sure I would say that in prose, but in verse, as long as it rhymes, it's probably okay.
How about the fact that you're doing this in The Nation? A little bit of preaching to the choir?
Well, the choir is getting bigger in The Nation now. Of course, The Nation, to everybody's complete embarrassment, is in the black now, thanks, I think, to George W. Bush.
But you know what I'm saying. You could say the left has Calvin Trillin, the right has W.H. Vondrilli, who writes for the National Review. Here's one of his. Hillary, it begins. Her library launch was inspired. Hill's hubby, triumphant but tired, bust Hillary as Hollywood. I swear almost half of it stood. Babs Streisand emoted the most. It goes on. You know, so one side speaks to one and one side speaks to the other.
Oh, well, I mean, it's the United States of America. You're supposed to have both sides. And I consider him my compadre because, according to the Washington Post, which did a piece when Obliviously Ani Sales came out, he gets the same amount of money that I do, which is $100 a poem. I was rather disappointed in that because I always thought of Bill Buckley as a generous-hearted man, whatever our political differences.
Just before we leave this topic of your book and your collection and your poems, who are you hoping for to win office for, you know, because it'll be better rhyming?
I guess it's too late for Ross Perot, but John McCain has the same qualities that Ross Perot had.
Yeah.
John McCain, it's a good rhyme, and there are people, I mean, I hate to say this about Hillary Clinton, but there's that name again.
Yeah. It's Clinton just does not work.
Clinton's not good.
Barack Obama does.
Well, Barack Obama is good, except I've used up most of those rhymes trying to deal with Osama bin Laden.
I want to just take a second and ask you, Calvin Trillin, about an essay that you wrote in March that ran in The New Yorker about your late wife, Alice. Such a prominent character in your writing, a beloved woman in her own right, a teacher, a mother, a muse. I love you. You begin the essay by saying, you know, how many people you'd heard from that felt they knew Alice, you know, because of your writing. And
right.
She was such an important part of Calvin Trillin-ness. Do you feel that loss in your writing? Do you, you know?
Yeah, I do. I was in a group of writers who were talking about who you used as a sort of a sounding board. And she was at and said, what do you do now? And I said, well, how does it affect your writing? And I said, it's very easy. The writing's not as good. I mean, it's very simple. I guess I don't show it to anybody now. But I think it's, you know, it's sort of just the luck of the draw to have somebody like that.
Do you mind reading for us a poem that you wrote about her being 50 at the time?
It's called A Conversation with Someone Who Can't Believe That Alice is 50. No way, you say, it simply cannot be. I would have guessed that bar men often ask her for ID. I know, I know. She has that youthful glow that still gives young men vapors. She's 50, though. I've seen her papers.
Author Calvin Trillin reading there about his late wife, Alice. His new book is A Heck of a Job, More of the Bush Administration in Rhyme. And Calvin Trillin, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about all of it.
Thank you, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.